So,
everybody
ready?
Okay.
So much.
Change out the gifts. Commonly known as school fair.
Yes.
Okay, the anatomy of the gastrointestinal tract. Okay, food goes down the esophagus, enters the stomach. Is the stomach sterile? Does the stomach have normal flora?
Sterile.
Pretty much sterile, but what do we know grows there? It causes ulcers.
Helicobacter pylori.
Helicobacter pylori does grow there. So there are a few organisms in there, but basically it's a sterile organism, so, or organ. As the food passes from the stomach, goes into the duodenum of the small intestine, we start picking up some normal flora, so that becomes colonized within the first few hours of life. There are a few organisms in there, but it's still kind of acid, particularly in the beginning part of it. So we have to then go into the large intestine, the ileum of, or the ascending portion of the large intestine, transverse, descending, rectum, and anus. That's where the majority of organisms exist, is in the large intestine. Okay, so look down here. This tells us that there are 10 to the 11th to 10 to the 12th organisms per gram of fecal matter. So that's a lot. In fact, about 80% of the dry weight of fecal matter is by organism.
Delicious.
Okay, we do have some normal flora in there. Non-pathogenic staph. What are bacteroides? Anybody know bacteroides? Bacteroides are anaerobes. A lot of animals in there, not just in addition to bacteroides, but that's the main one. There are some yeast, remember Enterococcus faecalis? What's Gram's name reaction, Enterococcus?
Gram-positive cocci,
right? Yes. Where do you think it gets its name, faecalis? It exists in the feces, so it's very normal in the feces. Okay. Then we get to the Enterobacteriaceae. That's what we're going to talk about this week. There's all kinds of genera of organisms in Enterobacteriaceae.
Okay, it sounds like a stupid question, but how did they originally get there? I mean, if you have to swallow them to get to, how did they get through the stomach?
I suppose they survived the acidity. If some of the food doesn't get entirely digested in the stomach, it can pass through and begins to colonize.
So, like the GI tract, would it be sterile in infancy?
Just within the first hour, but after the first couple hours or so, but within the first few hours, we begin to get colonization in the small intestine and in the large intestine. Okay, so this number is what you need to know, okay? 1,000 to 1, anaerobes to aerobes. 1,000 to 1, so it's mostly anaerobes that are there. The Enterobacteriaceae are facultative anaerobes, so they can exist with or without. But so that's what we're going to be studying this week. Okay, there are pathogens in there. Salmonella, Shigella, Campylobacter, and then a variety of others, even E. coli, which is usually normal flora, but there are some strains of E. coli that can be pathogenic. We'll talk about those more on Wednesday when we get into the disease. But what particular disease state are we talking about with stool samples? Starts with B.
Diarrhea.
Yeah, that's primarily what we're talking about. Diarrhea, dysentery, those types of things.
Delicious.
Okay, even Staph aureus can be a pathogen in there, Vibrio, blah, blah, blah. Okay, a lot of these things are rare. We're going to talk about those when we get to GI week 2. So we have 2 weeks of GI. Next week, being a short week, the rest of the university gets a holiday on Monday, but we're going to come. I had to wait there for a minute, didn't I? Okay, so Monday is a holiday. Thank heaven. So it's a short week next week. So that's why we can't do GI week 2 next week, because we need a regular week. So next week we're going to do non-commanders. We're going to stick that in there. Okay, so some of these rare ones, anyway, we'll talk about over the next 2 weeks. Every laboratory should culture for at least these three. Those are very common pathogens, so every laboratory should be able to identify at least those three, Salmonella. Don't worry about the species here, because we're going to talk about, it's not really species, we're going to talk about that later. Shigella species and Campylobacter. But, what do you think?
Sorry, he got a little overheated.
He's our streaker.
He was feeling really hot.
So we're going to talk about Campylobacter in 2 weeks, but Salmonella and Shigella we're going to do this week. So every lab, because those are tend to be the most common causative agents of diarrhea and dysentery. Okay, sample collection as a stool. There are different ways of describing any stool. It ranges anywhere from liquid to loose to soft to form to hard.
Why would we want to describe them?
Because.
Just because. It's fun. So, what type of sample do you think you would see in diarrhea?
Loose, liquid.
The first three usually are what we want: liquid, loose, soft. If we get a sample in the lab that's formed or hard, we're not likely to find a pathogen in there. So that's why we prefer the liquid, loose, or soft samples.
So on April Fool's Day, I brought in a stool sample that had baby was in it.
We need a fresh sample, preferably one that has been passed within the first hour or so, because some organisms are fragile and they will not survive changes in temperature or changes in pH. You guys that have taken toxicology probably know that to identify some of the parasites, amoebas and things, it has to be a warm sample, fresh warm sample. So we examine and culture it within 1 to 2 hours. Okay, sometimes we get a rectal swab, particularly from newborns or debilitated adults, if it's not easy or possible to get a good stool sample. Certain strains of Shigella we might be able to isolate from a rectal swab, but they cannot be dry rectal swabs, so they have to be put immediately into transport medium. Remember talking about Carrie Blair? What does Carrie Blair do? It's used only for fecal samples, and what it does is change the pH. It elevates pH from 7.4 to 8.4, and that helps facilitate the recovery of the pathogens. Okay, specimen collection continued. Unacceptable specimens would be an enema-induced specimen, probably because the liquid in the enema is toxic to the organisms. Refrigerated, it's probably okay to refrigerate it for maybe an hour or so, but again, some organisms, particularly Shigella, is very fragile, so they don't want to refrigerate it overnight. A sample that has been delayed being delivered to a lab for 1 to 2 hours. You don't know how long it's been sitting around the nursing station or whatever, so we usually reject those. And if we get a swab and it is dry, the organism's probably not going to be able to be recovered. So, again, your laboratory, each individual lab is going to have its own special criteria of how they reject or accept the sample. So that's what you need to know specifically for your laboratory. We usually will take one sample first. And if an organism is found, then we don't need any more samples. But if we don't find an organism, a pathogen, not just an organism, but a pathogen in the first sample, then 2 additional samples over the next few days. But it is not acceptable to receive multiple stool samples on the same day. So that's usually a rejection criteria.
Why is that?
If you can't, they can be passed sporadically. You don't always find them in there. And so it's better to wait another day. You might be more likely, if you can't find it that first day, more likely that the organism might have a chance to increase the numbers, proliferate more, and you'll have a better chance of isolating it. You do want to sample early in the course of the disease, however, because that facilitates.
Would it also be for parasites? Just in case, some of them need to hatch from the
body. Right. If you're looking for a parasite, that might be another thing. Yeah, we call them O&Ps, ova and parasite. But we're not going to talk about those, right? You probably learned about that in Did you?
No, we didn't.
Talk about it.
We did.
Okay, is a gram stain helpful when we do stool sample? Well, it's loaded with organisms. Usually the Enterobacteriaceae are in there. All the anaerobes are in there. Gram-negative rods, so you can't pick out a salmonella from an E. coli doing a gram stain. But there are some things we do look for. So we do the gram stain. Okay, so we're looking for a predominant number of white blood cells. We call those fecal leukocytes. Because if we've got a lot of those, that indicates probably some inflammatory reaction going on. So we look for fecal leukocytes. We look for an abundance of gram-positive cocci clusters, which might be evidence of Staph aureus as a pathogen, particularly if everything else is fairly normal. We look for yeast. Some people can have yeast as normal flora, but if we see an abundance of yeast, that could be an infection. And the absence of gram-negative organisms, because you would definitely expect to see a lot of gram-negative. So these are, we do a gram stain, and that's what we're primarily looking for in the gram stain.
So do we routinely do a gram stain, or do we do it if we order it?
Well, nowadays, they probably might have to order it separately because of the coding numbers. Whether we do a culture or a gram stain and a culture, there's different codes for everything. So, again, it kind of depends on the hospitals, what they accept. So they might have to order it separately. This is what a gram stain looks like. So you can see it's pretty impossible to really find a pathogen in there. A lot of this stuff is just undigested fecal matter, so there's all kinds of debris in there. But you look for those things that we just talked about. Okay, we're going to use a battery of media, so this is going to be a really fun week. You're going to have four different media that you're using. So you're going to have gram stain organisms on the four different media. You're going to have to correlate what's growing on McConkie versus HE or SBA or whatever. So you need to be prepared when you get in the lab tomorrow to know exactly what you're going to do, not waste time.
Where did these stool samples come from?
Trade secret.
Oh.
We don't reveal our secrets. Eventually, you will.
I just had a long week.
We'll learn.
Oh.
We'll tell you eventually.
Is it cat poop?
It is cat poop.
I'm not speaking.
That makes me want to fart.
So, have you changed diapers?
I'd rather change his poop than cat poop.
Well, it's not cat poop.
Is it human poop?
moving on. Okay. All right, here's the media. We use a supportive media. Usually, we always include a blood auger in there. We use a selective and differential, which can be either a McConkie or an EMB. Do you remember EMB? We used that second week, I guess. We used the methylene blue. Most labs will probably use McConkie. You remember what McConkie is used for now? Selective differential. Okay, so you know how to read a McConkie plate. Most labs will use McConkie, and that's what we're going to use. We're not going to use the EMB this week. Then we include a moderately selective, which tends to inhibit a little bit more some of the normal flora that might be present there and allow the pathogens to grow, but we tend to find that the normal flora, Enterobacteriaceae, do pretty well. We're going to use both HE, hectone enteric, which we used that second week. Remember what it looks like? Color?
Green.
And we're not going to use XOD. Xylose lysine decarboxylase, so it's helpful in certain situations because it does include a lysine decarboxylase reaction in there. But we're not going to use that one. Most labs probably won't. And we're going to use an SS, which stands for Salmonella Shigella auger. So it's a little bit more selective for Salmonella Shigella. But remember that other organisms will grow on there. So just because you see something on there, don't automatically assume it's Salmonella or Shigella. Then we can get into highly selective. So this is used primarily if you've got maybe an outbreak of Salmonella or something like that in the community or certain place. And that's all you're looking for, Salmonella. So we can use a bismuth sulfide or a brilliant green, and that tends to be more selective, so it's going to suppress more of the normal flora and allow us to have a better chance of recovering the salmonella. Most labs are not going to have this on hand, so they're not going to use that as routine culture media.
So those are selected specifically for salmonella?
Other things will grow. Yeah. Yeah, it's never always or never. But we have a better chance of isolating salmonella in those situations. And then there's an enrichment broth that some labs will use. There's two types. There's GN, which stands for, any guesses? Gram negative. I didn't make that one up. Somebody else did that. Okay, gram negative broth and selenite F broth. What enrichment broth does, this is different from enriched media. This is an enrichment broth. And what it tends to do is it inhibits or it keeps normal flora in the lag phase of growth. You remember lag phase versus log phase, those kinds of things. So it keeps normal flora in lag phase of growth and allows the pathogens, particularly Salmonella and Shigella, to be in the log phase of growth. So that allows them to grow and proliferate to a greater number while inhibiting the normal flora. But the thing we have to remember with enrichment broth is we put a little sample of our fecal sample in there and let it stay in there for maybe 6 hours, 4, 6, 9 hours, somewhere in there. And then we have to subculture it. So then we subculture it out to these other media, the plate media. Because after that period of time, then the normal flora can enter, they can start growing. They can overcome the lag phase of growth and start growing. So we don't want to leave it in the selenite broth overnight. That defeats the purpose, or the GM broth. Okay, so just to review, McConkie, these are lactose positives. Remember, they're pink. And lactose negatives are colorless. EMB, we get this metallic sheen on the lactose. So it's kind of hard to see there because the media is dark to begin with, but we're not going to use that one. Hecton enteric is green media. The lactose negatives are colorless or green, the color of the media, whereas lactose positives turn out to be this kind of salmon color, yellowish, orangish color. This media also has some ingredients in it that allow us to detect H2S. What color is H2S?
Black.
So you're looking for colonies with black centers. And that's important because salmonella is an H2S producer. So primarily what we're looking for initially in our initial examination of the media is non-lactose fermenters and then H2S positive organisms because those are more likely pathogens or at least salmonella. Shigella is H2S negative, but it is a non-lactose fermenter. So we're looking for non-lactose fermenters initially. Okay, and then this is the bismuth sulfite, which shows the salmonella. This shows Klebsiella will grow on there, but you can see kind of differences in the color of the organism. Okay, so we're going to use today a blood McConkie HENSS. Okay, let's go through some general characteristics, just of the enterobacteria ACA. In general, they are gram-negative rods. There's a gram stain. Some of them are short fat. E. coli tend to be more short fat. Others tend to be a little bit longer, maybe thinner or longer, but you really can't tell pathogens from normal flora from gram stain, like I've already mentioned. But they are gram-negative rods. They are all glucose fermenters. So when we talk about fermenters versus non-fermenters, in this case, we're talking about lactose. And we identify the lactose non-fermenters. But remember, they are all glucose fermenters. Okay, they are all oxidase negative. They are facultative anaerobes. They all reduce nitrates, but we're not going to do a nitrate test. And usually luxuriant growth, particularly on blood and MAC. So we didn't see that with our Klebsiella last week. We had a particular strain of Klebsiella that just refused to grow.
So reduce nitrate, will the dipstick, the urine dipstick, pick that up?
No. No, we use reagent drops. But we're not going to do that. Most labs probably will not do nitrate tests. And most of them are modal. And if they are modal, they have peritrichous flagella. What's peritrichous? All the way around the organism. Peritrichous. So most of them are modal. There are two genera we're going to talk about that are non-modal. So we'll mention those as we come to them.
So when you say all the way around, you mean just like one small strand around or all over the place?
just all over the surface of the organism.
It's just like really long cilia. Because ciliated organisms are the same way.
Yeah. Cilia are usually not used for locomotion unless it's some amoeba or some parasites that you see there. Flagella are used for locomotion. Cilia are more just moving in wave-like or stationary in our intestinal respiratory tract.
So I don't quite understand. Could you draw it on the board?
Draw what?
The
peritrichus. Oh, gosh. What do you think I am? Okay, here's our gram-negative rod. Don't have a red one. So the flagella are just going to be little squiggly things, and they're just going to be all over the whole. This is, of course, just two-dimensional. Okay. Like that. The other, well, some of them can be just unipolar. They can just have flagella on one pole. Or some of them can be bipolar, with flagella on both poles. But peritrichus is all the way around. That's not bad. Okay, some of the tests we use. Okay, we have to determine carbohydrate utilization. We do that by TSI. So remember how to use, read TSI now? Because you're going to have to depend on this a lot this week. Okay, what does TSI stand for?
Triple sugar.
Triple sugar ion agar. So what triple sugars are in there?
Lactose, maltose.
Whichever ones you select.
Those are the CPA sugars.
These are
TSI. Glucose, lactose, maltose, sucrose. Those are the three sugars that are in. Plus, it's got iron in there. Okay. So, organisms, because these are all glucose fermenters, right? All glucose fermenters. So initially, they will utilize, or they'll turn the whole tube yellow. If we were to look at these probably in 16 to 18 hours or so, it'll be yellow. Then, there's about 10 times as much lactose and sucrose in amoeba as there is glucose. So they all turn the butt yellow. The butt is always yellow. Even if it's got so much H2S in there that we can't see the butt, it is still yellow because the glucose is metabolized more anaerobically, and so the butt will remain yellow. If the organism can utilize the lactose in the media or the sucrose, then it will turn the slant. The slant will remain yellow from the acid produced from the sugar. Okay, if it can't utilize the lactose, then once it's exhausted the glucose up here in the slant, then it uses the amines that are in there. And it turns the amines, or it produces amines, produces an alkaline reaction. And that changes the indicator to red. So the slant will then turn red. And that indicates it's a non-lactose fermenter, but the butt is always yellow. If it can produce H2S, we'll get black in there. We may not get as much black as this. We might just get some little specks of black. But look carefully, because any black is positive for H2S. Now, we have to have some special ingredients in there in order to detect the H2S. First of all, we've got to have some sulfur in the media. So any of the plates, the hectone enteric, the HE, and the SS plate also will detect black, because they've got these ingredients in their media. But that's why we can't detect it on the conchae, because it does not have these ingredients. So it has to have some sulfur in there. What happens is the organism, it releases sulfide by some of its enzymes, and the sulfide combines with hydrogen to form the H2S. But we can't see it yet. We have to have an indicator. So the indicator is iron. That's where the iron comes from. It's either in the form of ferric sulfate or ferric citrate, and the H2S will then bind with the iron, and that produces the black color. So you've got to have those two ingredients in there in order to detect H2S. TSI is usually more sensitive than the plates, the HE or the SS, for detecting H2S. Okay, so we can have K over A with H2S. We can also have A over A with H2S. And then this one is A over A with gas. So the gas can move the media up. It can even blow the top off the tube. Or it might be just a little bubble or a little crack in the media. It doesn't have to be this much. But gas is probably the least important criterion because some organisms will produce it sometimes and not other times. So don't rely heavily on gas production. Okay, OMPG activity. Some organisms are slow lactose fermenters. We can use the OMPG test to detect. They are still lactose fermenters, but it takes them a longer period of time. So initially on the TSI, they're probably going to appear as non-lactose fermenters. So we can do an OMPG test to help us determine whether they're lactose fermenters or not. We're not going to do this, but some labs will. This is what happens. The organism, in order to be a lactose fermenter, requires two enzymes. So here's our lactose. The lactose has to get inside the organism before it can be utilized. There is an enzyme called beta-galactoside permease, which allows the lactose to get inside the cell. Then once inside the cell, beta-galactosidase breaks down the lactose. This is lactose, which consists of glucose and lactose, and utilizes it. There are some organisms, the slow lactose fermenters, do not have this enzyme, beta-galactoside permease. So that's why it takes a longer period of time. They're still lactose fermenters because they still have the beta-galactosidase enzyme. But it takes a longer period of time for the lactose to get inside. So initially, we observe them on the TSI as non-lactose fermenters. But we can do this test, and it's a tube test, using ONPG, which is a substance that it's orthonitrophenyl glucose, I guess. It replaces the glucose here and enables this to enter the cell rapidly without that enzyme. So a positive test is yellow. Negative test is clear and cloudy. Okay, so that's one test that can be done. We're not going to do that one, but you need to know what ONPG tells you and why it's important to detect that some organisms are indeed lactose positive. Okay, you know how to do the indole. We're going to use the spot indole, so we've all done that. And you know all about MRVPs. Okay, you know all about citrates. Urease we've done. Some organisms can't or do have enzyme urease, which converts urea. And what color is a positive urease? Hot pink. Tycoon. Urease tie. Where your tie this week. Okay, I'll help you remember. And you know how to do decarboxylation tests. Okay, we've usually done the lysine decarboxylation, but there are a couple other amino acids that we can put in there. So we can do an orthine decarboxylation or an arginine decarboxylase. How do we do a decarboxylase test? Remember, you have to overlay it. So you stab it, and then overlay it with mineral oil to create somewhat anaerobic conditions. So what color is a positive lysine decarboxylase? What color is it to start out with, uninoculated?
Purple.
Yes. So what color is a positive lysine decarboxylase?
Yellow.
Yellow is negative. It's purple, remains purple, and cloudy. Okay, it has to be cloudy, so you know the organism has grown in there.
Isn't this the one that goes like from purple to yellow back to purple?
Yes. If it's yellow, it's negative, which means it cannot decarboxylase the amino acid, but it utilizes the sugar that's in there, probably glucose that's in there, and ferments it and changes the indicator to a yellow color. Now, sometimes the indicator breaks down a little bit, so instead of getting a purple and cloudy, it'll be more like a grayish color. That's okay. That's still positive as long as it's cloudy and not purple and clear. If it's purple and clear, like an uninoculated tube, then the organism probably didn't grow, and you can't report it. You need to do it over again. Okay, we're going to do a new one called phenylalanine deaminase. This is a tube test. You don't really have to stab this one. It's just mostly on the streak. You just streak it good, incubate it overnight, and then add 5 drops of 10% ferric chloride. If it can deaminate phenylalanine with the ferric chloride, it will turn a greenish color, the slam. Usually it's not quite that obvious. Usually it's kind of a very white-green color.
How long does it take to turn that color?
Within a minute, usually. usually pretty, yeah, couple minutes, couple minutes after adding the ferric chloride. Colorless or no change is negative. Okay, the H2S, we've already talked about, we have to have the sulfur in there and the indicator, which is ferric citrate, ferric sulfate, something about the iron in there. And then motility, and we should have some special different motility media this week, which will help us better detect motility than what we were using before. Okay, what I'm going to do now is race through a few of the Enterobacteriaceae, the most important ones in terms of, well, the most common ones that we isolate from a stool sample. And I'm not going to give you their whole reactions. I'm just going to give you a couple reactions to help distinguish them here. So you really need to rely on your textbook this week. There's charts in there, page 524 or something like that. There's three pages of charts in there that give you these organisms and all kinds of different reactions. But we do have a flow diagram we're going to use, too, so I'll show you that. Okay, Citrobacter freundii. Can you say that? Freundii, okay. You can walk a walk, you can talk the talk. Citrate positive. What do you think it's got its name, Citrobacter, from? Citrate positive. Okay, it is lactose positive, but sometimes it can be slow. So that means on the TSI, we can get either an A over an A, or we can get a K over A. So how do we determine? If we get a K over A, how do we determine if it's really a lactose fermenter?
Do it again.
ONPG. ONPG. Okay, but we're not going to do that, so you don't have that help this time. And it is H2S positive. The reason that's significant is because, particularly if we get a K over A and H2S positive, that's exactly what Salmonella does. And so remember, you're initially looking for Salmonella, Shigella, Campylobacter. We're not doing Campylobacter this week, so don't worry about that one. But we want non-lactose fermenters and H2S. Okay. Let me go back to Citrobacter. Citrobacter is usually normal flora in the stool. Most of these Enterobacteriaceae, with the exception of the Salmonella shigella, which are always pathogens, most of them, if they're in the stool, the intestinal tract, they're normal flora. If they get out of the intestinal tract into a wound or urinary tract, they're pathogens. But in the intestinal tract, they're usually normal flora. Okay, Edwards zeala tarda. K over A. Tarda means it's very slow, takes a long time to utilize the lactose in there. So it's K over A and H2S. So again, it can look like Salmonella. This one is debatable as to whether or not it's really a pathogen. In some rare cases, it can be a pathogen, but usually it's pretty much normal flora, but it initially looks like Salmonella. Okay, Enterobacter, three species. Now remember, this is Enterobacter, not Enterococcus. Okay, don't confuse those. Enterobacter orogenes, cloacae, and agglomerans. A over A. And this is pretty much a gas. Usually produces a lot of gas. In fact, it used to be called aerogenes. That used to be the name of the genus name, aerogenes, because of all the air and the gas that it produces. But they changed it to Enterobacter. Okay, A over A, gas producer. Hafnia, and this one is normal flora. Again, intestinal tract, normal flora. Hafnia alvea, or alveae, used to be Enterobacter alveae. But now it's in a different genus, so again, these are always changing. That one's usually normal flora as well. At best, it's an opportunistic pathogen. E. coli. Okay, there are different strains of E. coli. We're going to go through these Wednesday, so let's not worry about these today. Most of the E. coli that we encounter are normal flora. But we can get a certain strain that can be pathogenic. So we'll talk about the disease states on Wednesday. E. coli is generally 98% of the time A over A. But there is a non-lactose fermenting E. coli. It's normal flora, even though it's non-lactose fermenter. And not all non-lactose fermenters are pathogens. It's just that most of the pathogens are non-lactose fermenters. Gas plus or minus, so you may or may not see gas. And remember the Invic reaction, what does it stand for? Enol, methylred, Welch-Proskauer, citrate. Okay, So we're going to set up these tubes, and we've already done these. So classically, E. coli is positive, negative, negative. That's easy to remember, right? Positive, positive, negative, negative. E. coli. Okay. There's our E. coli reaction. So TSI A over A. Here's methyl red positive, EPD negative, citrate negative. This is motility. It is modal, but that's you really can't see that on there. But it is modal. Because most of these are modal. Okay, Klebsiella, A over A. Usually a gas producer, usually mucoid. However, last week we didn't really see that. We had a strain that just wasn't going to grow mucoid. So we're trying to get some other strains to see if we can get the classical. Let's pick that up. Picture here. Remember this picture? That's usually what Klebsiella should look like. It's got a nice big gooey capsule on it, which makes it gooey, sometimes stringy like that. But of course, we didn't see that last week. That's the typical Klebsiella reaction. Whereas E. coli is very lactose positive, so it's pink. But the colonies for E. coli are a little smaller and flatter and dry looking. So E. coli is not mucoid like that. Okay, the imphic reaction for Klebsiella is just the opposite of E. coli. Negative, negative, positive, positive. And how many genera did I say were non-modal?
Two.
Okay, this is one of them. Klebsiella is non-modal. Klebsiella is non-modal. Klebsiella is non-modal. Do you want me to draw it, Patrick?
Yeah.
He's
definitely
non-modal.
Yeah, there you go.
Draw.
Draw
modal. There's Klebsiella. there is, and again, Klebsiella is usually normal flora in the intestinal tract. But as we saw last week, it can cause pneumonia, it can get up into the respiratory tract to be a pathogen, it can get the urinary tract to be a pathogen, into wounds. So if it leaves the intestinal tract, then any of these really can be pathogens at that time. There is one species of Klebsiella, most common one we find is Klebsiella pneumoniae. There is one species called Klebsiella oxytoca, which is endopositive. So in the event that you pretty much sure you've got a Klebsiella, but it turns out to be endopositive, it might be that species. Proteus. Okay. Proteus is always K over A and H2S positive. So again, initially it's going to resemble Salmonella. It is urea positive. There's our hot pink. There's two species of Proteus that we're going to be concerned with, Mirabilis and Vulgaris. And the way we tell them apart is by the endo reaction. Mirabilis is endo negative. Vulgaris is endopositive. Proteus is normal flora in the intestinal tract. Occasionally it exhibits this condition called swarming, in which it just grows confluent over the whole plate and contaminates everything. When you get that, you just want to throw it out the window. It's pretty hard to do anything else with it. And we'll probably have, I think we're going to do more Proteus in a couple weeks. Maybe we'll have a swarming one. Okay, Morganella morgani. K over A, urea positive, phenylalanine, deaminase positive. Proteus is also phenylalanine, deaminase positive. There's three genera, Proteus, Morganella, and Providencia, that are urea positive and phenylalanine, deaminase positive. Okay, Salmonella. Don't worry about these names. We're going to discuss this more on Wednesday. We're not going to speciate our Salmonella anyway. If we get a Salmonella, we're just going to call it Salmonella. K over A, H2S positive, and lysine decarboxylase positive. Well, that's how we differentiate from some of these others. K. Shigella.
Is Salmonella the first one on this list that's usually a pathogen, not known for?
Yes. Salmonella is always a pathogen. Shigella is always a pathogen. There's four species of Shigella. Dysenteriae is the least common, fortunately, because it is the most virulent, and that causes a dysentery. And again, on Wednesday, we'll differentiate diarrheas and dysenteries. The most common in the U.S. is Shigella sonii. We're not going to speciate Shigella again, so if we get Shigella, we're just going to call it Shigella. Okay, there's K over A and non-modal. What was the other one that was non-modal? Klebsiella. So those are two non-modal ones, Klebsiella and Shigella. And it's pretty much inert, which means if you do a battery of tests, you're going to start coming out with negative, 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 negative on a lot of things. So when you start to see that, but it just doesn't react with a lot of sugars and other things, that's suspicious of Shigella. Okay, Serratia marcescens. This one produces a red pigment, so this is not actually lactose fermentation. This is a pigment that it produces. And we used to think this was just normal flora, but the last several years, they're finding out that it can be a pathogen. It can be A or K over A. Yersinia is one of the Enterobacteriaceae, but we're not going to discuss this until 2 weeks, GI week 2, so let's not worry about Yersinia right now. Okay. If we identify a Salmonella or Shigella primarily, we usually will do a serological classification based on different antigens. And we can, some labs will do this themselves, or they'll send it to a reference lab to do it. The O antigen is the somatic antigen. That's the cell wall. That's lipopolysaccharide in the cell wall. The K antigen is the capsular antigen for those organisms that have capsules. And the H antigen is the flagellar antigen, the flagella. Okay, and I should have put E. coli on this list too. And we'll talk about that on Wednesday. But there is a serological test we do for a certain strain of E. coli that is pathogenic based on the H antigen. Okay, now this week we're going to do an API. Anybody familiar with APIs?
Whoa.
Okay, this is a fun test, and it's a strip like this, so you'll all get one strip. And it's got all of these little couplets in here. And what we do is after we've identified our suspected pathogen or Enterobacteriaceae, this is only done on Enterobacteriaceae. So gram-positives are possible this week. If you get a gram-positive cocci, do not do an API on it. This is only for Enterobacteriaceae. We make a suspension of our suspected organism. And then we add, just using a pipette, we add a little bit of that to each one of these couplets. Your instructions are in your lab manual. So you need to read your lab manual. Probably will not do these tomorrow, but we'll probably set them up on Wednesday. So make sure you read your instructions and kind of understand how to do it. I'm not going to go through that procedure, how to do it now. After you set them up, we incubate them for 24 hours, and then we read them. We read them in groups of three. So we record, and I'll give you a special paper to record it on. We record positive when the reaction is positive or negative. That's what all these are. And it tells you in your lab manual which ones are positive and what to look for, what a positive reaction looks like. And then we add up all the positives. So we take our groups of three and we add the positive. The first one is worth 4 points. The second one is 2, and the last one is 1. So this one is 5. Everybody see that one? This one is 2. That one, oops, maybe the first one is 1. And the second and the last one is 4. But maybe I'm confusing you. But reading your book as to what the numbers are. We should get a 5-digit number after doing that. We then take that 5-digit number, and I've got a big, thick book, and we look through there and find our number. And this is based on thousands and thousands of doing these reactions and tell you the most likely organism.
There's 7 numbers, so how do you get 5 digits?
What, did I say 5-digit? Yeah. I was looking at 5. 7-digit number.
Oh, good.
You should get a 7-digit number, yeah.
I can hallucinate some things, but 5
yeah,
to 7 numbers is pretty rough.
Sorry about that. Okay, we got to hurry. We got 5 minutes left. We need to get into the lab procedure. Okay, you're going to have 4 knowns, Salmonella, Shigella, Proteus, E. coli. One of you do Salmonella and either a Proteus or an E. coli, and the other one do a Shigella and either a Proteus or an E. coli. We're going to streak them on blood, Meconcae, HESS, and today for the knowns only, we're going to do a TSI. Why can we do that today? Because these are pure cultures. We cannot do a TSI if we have a mixed culture, just like anything else. But these are pure cultures, so we're going to save this day, and we're going to do the TSI on each of these today, and a gram stain. For the unknown, also known as stool sample. Okay, we're going to streak that on blood, Meconcae, HESS, and gram stain, initial gram stain. Now you're going to do this with a swab, so you're going to each get a little cup of sample. You're going to get a swab, and you're going to run the swab around in it, rotate it around so that you kind of sample all the areas, and particularly if you see any bloody areas or mucusy or something, that's what you want to sample. Get some on your swab, then do confluent growth or confluent swabbing on the primary quadrant of your plates. If you need to get more samples, go back and get more samples for your other plates. And then roll your swab on the gram stain or on the slide do the gram stain, then remember to go back and restreak it with your needle.
Needle or loop?
Loop. Just want to make sure you're listening. Okay, with your loop. So streak for isolation. Okay. Okay, so we're not doing a TSI on the unknown because we don't know what's in there. It's a mixed culture. So Tuesday through Thursday, well, probably Wednesday, we set up an API. One API on an unknown, Enterobacteriaceae unknown. Okay, not a gram-positive unknown. Read the lab procedure. But in addition to doing the API, we're also going to do the flowchart. So this is our flowchart. You have one in your book, and it's similar to this one, but I've added a couple additional tests. I don't know if these are on your chart. You probably have to write them down. But remember I said that they should all be oxidase negative. The ones that we talk about in week two are going to be oxidase positive. So do an oxidase test. Has to be oxidase negative. Then the next thing we do is a TSI. So you can't set up all these other tests until you've done the TSI because it depends on what the reaction is. If it hasn't changed, it's alkaline over alkaline, those are the non-lactose fermenters that we're going to talk about next week. So those are not possible this week. A over A, plus or minus gas, we're going to set up an INVIC. Positive, positive, negative, negative, E. coli. Negative, negative, positive, positive, could be Klebsiella or Enterobacter. So then we're going to do a motility. And I put MIO in here because we used to use MIOs, but we're just going to do a motility. Motility and ornithine decarboxylase. Positive refers primarily to the motility here. So if it's negative, it's Klebsiella. As long as it's still negative, it's Klebsiella pneumoniae. If we get a positive motility, then it could be either Serratia or Enterobacter. You need to do a lysine decarboxylase to differentiate those. I didn't put the reactions down here, so there's no room, but you can find those reactions in your book. Okay, if it's K over A, no H2S, then we'll do a phenylalanine deaminase. If it's positive, we'll do a urea. And if we get in this column, we do a citrate to differentiate those. So you just follow your flow diagrams and make sure you add these tests if you happen to get into one of those groups. Okay, if it's K over A with H2S or A over A with H2S, then we're down here. And this is where our salmonella is. Our shigella is over in this column because it's mostly negatives. Phenylalanine negative, urea negative. Non-modal, so our shigella is mostly over here, but Klebsiella, or salmonella is over here, where it's K over A, H2S, urea negative, lysine, decarboxylase positive. Cross out Arizona, because that's really a subspecies of salmonella.
What about that malonate?
Cross off malonate, we're not doing that.
So
cross
we'll go straight to the indole.
Yeah, go straight to the indole. Oops. So just add what I've indicated up here. Add a citrate to this group, cross off the Arizona, the malonate.
And the LDs are found in our microbome.
Oh, yes, the reaction should be. If you get into that group, you should be able to differentiate it. Okay, so any questions then? All right, the fun begins. Let's go. Let's go do it.
Oh, now we see.
In my hands. He always is like that right before he gets to sleep.
I mean, I'm tired.